This is episode 96 of the Osteopathic Manipulative Medicine podcast, where we share clinical stories and pearls related to osteopathic medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ben Green, a third-year neuromusculoskeletal medicine resident at Michigan State University. Today, because I did not have a special guest, I thought I would present to you all a lecture that I just gave in Seoul, Korea, to the Chuna Manual Medicine physicians there, the KMDs, about the zinc model, a postural model, and the relationship to the thoracolumbar fascia and pelvic cross syndrome. So hopefully this is a topic that interests you all. I started the talk out talking about how in osteopathic medicine, much as in the Chuna philosophy of manual medicine, we look at the person from the standpoint of mind, body, and spirit. In this lecture, I'm going to spend most of my time talking about the body, the physical manifestation of the person, but that doesn't mean that we should ignore the mind and the spirit. I think those are equally, if not maybe even more important. The lecture is broken down into four sections. The underlying theme is structure and function are interrelated. The first section of the talk, the first of four, talks about the zinc model as a postural model. The second topic is the importance of fascia within the postural model. Third topic is the thoracolumbar fascia and its relationship to the postural model. And finally, the fourth and final topic, we went over manipulative treatments of pelvic cross syndrome, which is a manifestation of functional asymmetry at the lumbosacral junction. Obviously, I can't demonstrate for you live. We probably should have done a live Instagram feed, but we can kind of talk through the different modalities of treatment that I showed to them. So, first topic, the zinc model is essentially a postural model. This first section comes primarily from an article written by Ross E. Pope, D.O., titled The Common Compensatory Pattern, Its Origin and Relationship to the Postural Model. So the Common Compensatory Pattern, or the CCP, or referred to as the zinc model, was clinically discovered by Gordon Zink, D.O., and he looked at hundreds, maybe thousands of patients, and the CCP, the common compensatory pattern, is the myofascial pattern that he repeatedly saw in these patients. This is a term used to describe commonly found patterns in the normal neuromyofascial skeletal unit. It implies an inherent fascial bias, and these inherent fascial biases are also indicative of anatomical weakness, and they're found in the transition zones. So I think of these transition zones much like the Achilles heel, right? So Achilles, this Greek who was almost invincible, right? You remember the story of Achilles' mother dipping him into the river Styx, holding him by the Achilles tendon. So everything was immortal. Everything was impenetrable except the Achilles heel. The Achilles heel for us mortals seems to be the transition zones. So the OA, where you have the cranial cervical junction and you have the fascial pole, according to the zinc model, of the tentorium cerebelli. Then you have the CT junction, the cervical thoracic junction, and there you have the myofascial pole of the thoracic inlet and outlet. Next, you've got the TL junction, thoracolumbar junction, and you have your respiratory diaphragm. So there's also a myofascial pole there, according to the zinc model. And finally, the LS zone or the lumbosacral junction, where you have the pelvic diaphragm. Now, the common compensatory pattern, just because you have a common compensatory pattern, does not mean that you have pain. Doesn't equal pain. So at C0, C2, what Dr. Zink said you commonly find there is a myofascial pole to the left. And he correlated this to embryology and to being the delivery process vaginally. It's pretty complicated embryology. So C7T1, he talks about that fascial pole at the thoracic inlet outlet being a myofascial pole to the right. T12L1, myofascial pole to the left at the respiratory diaphragm. L5, he said, was rotated to the right. So the pelvic diaphragm is going to myofascially pull to the right. And the sacrum, what he commonly found in his patients, was a left-on-left forward sacral torsion. And he also mentioned that he didn't see that these patients, well, one, they didn't have pain, but they also didn't significantly seem to be limited in their daily function. And he thought maybe the CCP could be a pattern of health. So the transition zones, could they be a source of pain? So if they follow the CCP, the left-right-left-right pattern, oftentimes not a source of pain. But when could they be a source of pain? That's the question we're asking ourselves. So we're looking at postural symmetry versus postural asymmetry. And this is where I'm introducing the Zinc model as a postural model. So according to Pope in this article, there are three aspects of the postural model. There is the anatomic symmetry or asymmetry, and that's comparing the left side of the body to the right side of the body anatomically. So to give an example, is the left arm shorter than the right? Is there a short left leg compared to the right leg? The next aspect he talked about was mass symmetry versus asymmetry. So is the front side of the body proportional to the back side? Is the left side proportional to the right side? And next, and there is, yeah, you're probably saying, well, anatomy and mass, those are pretty similar, and that's true. I think anatomically he's thinking more skeletal symmetry, and mass he's thinking more of muscle symmetry. And then finally, the final category, when we talk about the three aspects of the postural model, we talk about functional symmetry and asymmetry, and this is where I spend a lot of my time in the talk. So when we talk about symmetry of steppage gait, so is the stride on with right heel strike the same length as the stride on the left with left heel strike? Is there symmetry there or is there asymmetry? If there's asymmetry, that could be a source of pain. What about joint range of motion? Is the right range of motion of the right shoulder symmetric to the left, or is there limitation in, let's say, internal rotation on the right relative to the left internal rotation of the left glenohumeral joint? That could be potentially a source of discomfort and pain. We also talk about, when we're talking about functional symmetry versus asymmetry, we're talking about agonist and antagonist muscle firing patterns. So commonly we see with low back pain, right glute, left glute, the glutes just aren't firing. Is one firing and one not firing? That would be a muscle imbalance. So the muscle firing pattern, there is asymmetry there. That could also be a source of discomfort and pain. Okay, but what else could be influencing functional symmetry and asymmetry? What else could be influencing the discrepancy between steppage gait, the discrepancy or the lack of range of motion comparing left to right side, or agonist antagonist muscle firing patterns? And this is where I introduced the concept of the tensegrity of the person. So tensegrity, why are we introducing this? If you can tension the system in a healthy fashion, meaning the opposite of compressing the myofascial system, you're more likely to have functional symmetry. It's that simple. You're more likely to have proper joint range of motion, equal steppage gait, and proper muscle firing patterns throughout the body. Why? Because the system is tensioned properly, meaning the muscles are not inhibited. So tensegrity, it's introducing this concept of continuous tension with discontinuous compression. And it has functional consequences. So when the system is in healthy tensegrity, it's strong, the body is strong, it's flexible, it's lightweight, it's energy efficient, and it's stable in all directions. You're distributing stress evenly throughout the entire body from one side to the other. And stability is not dependent on an individual elements. It's each one of the elements working together. I'm sure you've all seen the images of the tensegrity models on the internet. But, you know, I'm looking at a tensegrity model of the lower extremities, the hips and the lower extremities. And it's made with these dowel rods that are connected by, looks like elastic bands. So if you just move one of those dowel rods a little bit, the whole structure moves slightly and the tensile forces change a little bit. So this quote from Rolf Rolfing in 1977, he says, when one part moves, the body as a whole responds. Functionally, the only tissue that can mediate such responsiveness is the connective tissue. So I'm thinking about the fascial system. So structure and function are, as we know, intimately interrelated. So you can have tensegrity on one side where agonist and antagonist forces act to maintain our body within a conus of energy economics, or you can have compression, imbalance, leading to muscles of the spine and the pelvis requiring more energy to fire, leading to fatigue, leading to discomfort, and oftentimes leading to pain. So you could paint this picture in your mind of a lot of us who have desk jobs and have what we call commonly poor posture, where we're slumped forward. Our shoulders are caved in an anterior fashion. Our sacrum is counternutated. Our pelvis, we have a posteriorly rotated pelvis, and our anterior muscles of our abdomen, our deep core stabilizers, our transversus abdominis, our obliques are just shut off. Why? Because they can't fire when you're in hip flexion, or they can't fire as efficiently when you're compressed forward like that. So I introduced the concept of tech neck. So we spend a lot of times in, you know, nowadays on our phones, on social media, and we're looking down, right? Our neck, our cervical spine is flexed forward. One of my fellow residents, Dr. Jordan Little, who has been a co-host on the podcast, he was talking to us in didactics one afternoon about the cervical spine. When you just move it 1 inch into forward flexion, you are putting about 10 pounds more of stress weight on your axial spine. So just imagine 2 inches, it's like 20 pounds, and then 3 inches of forward flexion, 30 pounds, right? So you can see how people would have mid-thoracic and then eventually low back pain if they stay in those positions for long periods of time. The next slide in the presentation, I showed them some images of postural tensegrity, looking at that posterior fascial train from the Achilles heel all the way up to the cranium, right? So through the Achilles tendon, the biceps femoris, the gastroc, the biceps femoris, through the sacrotuberous ligament and glutes, up the fascia, the thoracolumbar fascia, all the way up into the occiput. I showed them a picture of the myofascial, a myofascial dissection, actually showing that whole myofascial train. So then it kind of begs the question, are there really 600 muscles in the body? As we learn in anatomy class, in my case, first and second year of medical school, or are there one muscle with 600 fascial pockets? It's kind of revolutionizing, kind of flipping the coin on how we think about the musculoskeletal system. It's all really interconnected myofascially. So key takeaway points from this section: the transition zones are the Achilles heel of the axial myofascial system. The CCP is a postural model based in tensegrity. Asymmetry in anatomy, mass, or function may lead to pain. It's not guaranteed, but possibly could lead to pain. The postural model is a model of tensegrity with the myofascial system at its core. Okay, so that was the first section. 15 minutes in. Second section, I talked about fascia. So the importance of fascia within the postural model. This is not just a throwaway tissue that you just dissect out and throw it away and forget about it. There's value to it. But what is the value? So this paper, it's a little old. It's from 2014. But the paper is titled Fascia, Current Knowledge and Future Directions in Physiatry. It's a narrative review. And it's divided up into four sections. The first section is conceptualizing fascia. Second section, the role of fascia in force transmission, which I think is really interesting. The third section is fascia innervated. Never really thought about that. And fourth, well, if it's innervated, could fascia be a pain generator? I really like this quote from Still. I think there's some truth to it. He says, "The fascia is the place to look for the cause of disease and the place to consult and begin the action of remedies in all disease." So let's conceptualize fascia first. What is this stuff? Fascia, fasciae, Latin term, means bundle, bandage, strap, unification, and binding together. Structures in the body often referred to as fascia are the dense connective tissue, areolar connective tissue, so that tissue just underneath the skin. You have deep and superficial fascial layers, the interosseous membrane, obviously, intermuscular septae, and then fascia surrounds all of our skeletal muscles. So the epimysium, the paramecium, the endomysium, and also our bones, so the periosteum. You have those neurovascular tracts, which are formed by fascia. And then you have the inter and extramuscular, the aponeuroses of the body are all fascial. So it's all over the place. So does fascia have a role in force transmission? So we know that fascia is this dynamic tension network, right? We recall the tensegrity models that we've seen on the internet. There are different densities of fascia, and the arrangements of collagen fibers are laid down by fibroblasts and fasciocytes. They're the cells that are making fascia. They're like the fascial silkworms, right, of the body. The myofascial forces may be transmitted epimuscularly, meaning outside of the skeletal muscle force transmission. And there was a study done where they actually completely transected the FCU, or the flexor carpi ulnaris, and then they put electrical stimulation on the FCU, and they still saw residual wrist flexion. So the FCU, we know it. We know that that muscle helps with wrist flexion, but that muscle was completely cut. They went to stimulate just that muscle, and they still saw residual wrist flexion. So the researchers thought that potentially up to 30% of muscle tension may be transmitted via extramuscular force transmission, potentially through fascial trains. I thought that was really interesting. You know, from my medical school training, man, I just thought it's just the skeletal muscle doing all the work. But maybe not. The fascia seems to also be playing a role in joint mobility, joint movement. Is fascia innervated? Well, we talk about diagnoses all the time that have fascia in the name. Example, plantar fasciitis. We talk about myofascial pain syndrome. We talk about myofascial trigger points. So it's in a lot of our diagnoses. Is it innervated? Well, the answer is absolutely it is. So there are free nerve endings. And in fact, the superficial fascia of the hip has the second most innervated tissue after the skin. Tezars et al. In this article said that the thoracolumbar fascia is innervated with both nociceptive, so pain receptors, and sympathetic fibers. So it responds when we're in fight or flight, the fascial system. There are also Ruffini and Pacini corpuscles suggesting that the fascia has a proprioceptive function. That's really interesting. So it sends information to the central nervous system about where our body is in 3D space, or if our body is being compressed or being stretched. So fascia is, not only does it look like this spider web of tissue throughout the body, it is also continuously sending information back to our central nervous system. So could repetitive mechanical strain of fascia be a pain generator? Well, they did this experiment where they put fascia or dermal fibroblasts in petri dishes. And they saw that when they repetitively mechanically strained them, so they put this vacuum suction on these fibroblasts that were stuck to petri dishes, they saw an increase in inflammatory mediators like substance P, calcitonin gene-related peptide, bradykinin, 5-HT, norepinephrine, tumor necrosis factor alpha, and interleukin-1 beta. All of these are inflammatory mediators, and they all increased when the fibroblasts were strained. They also saw a change in gene expression, particularly of the extracellular matrix. So they saw a decrease in hyaluronic acid. Now, hyaluronic acid is primarily made of glucosaminoglycans. Glucosaminoglycans are highly polarized. They're a highly polarized molecule, much like water. And being a polarized molecule, water being a polarized molecule, they attract each other. So when you have more hyaluronic acid, meaning you have more glucosaminoglycans and more polarized molecules, you're going to attract more water to the fascia. And drawing more water, you're going to have more lubrication. You're going to have decreased shearing forces of the myotendinous unit. What they've seen in chronic low back pain patients is decreased movement between the thoracolumbar fascia. So, I mean, it could be for a multitude of reasons. Maybe they're just not drinking and they're chronically dehydrated. Maybe they're just also increasing in age and their fascia is becoming less elastic. But also it could be that they are repetitively mechanically straining their fascia by being compressed, by having a poor posture, also influenced by being dehydrated. So correcting your posture could decrease the mechanical strain that you're putting, particularly on your thoracolumbar fascia. And that could potentially decrease inflammatory markers and increase tissue glidability. Now, I don't know of any studies that have been done on human models. The study that I just referred to was done in the in vitro setting. So I can't say, well, this absolutely correlates to what would happen in an actual person. So I'm speculating. But I think there is definitely probability that this could be the case. In a paper done by, it was done at A.T. Still University in 2010, Dr. Hollis King, I know, was on this study, where they looked at images from in vitro modeling of repetitive motion injury and then doing myofascial release on these cells, they saw decrease in edema and inflammation. Patients after doing myofascial release reported decrease in analgesic use, so use of any kind of pain modulating medication. They saw an increase in range of motion in affected joints, and the myofascial release effects after 60 seconds of repetitive mechanical strain saw a decrease in the DAPK2 marker, which is a regulator of programmed cell death. They saw a reduction in that protein by 10%, meaning that there was a reduction in apoptosis of fibroblasts. So fibroblasts with myofascial release seem to live a longer lifetime and died less quickly. So key takeaway points from this section: fascia is a dynamic tension network. It has contractile capability, it's innervated, and healthy fascia is key to muscle and connective tissue glidability. And then if you repetitively mechanically strain fascia, you're going to increase inflammatory markers, increase apoptosis of fibroblasts, and there is a positive correlation, I'm not saying causation, but correlation with pain. And there's decreased tissue glidability when you repetitively mechanically strain the fascia. Okay, that's section two. Section three, we're talking about the thoracolumbar fascia and the relationship to the postural model. This is taken from an article. I don't know why I like these articles from 2014, but this is also from 2014, done by Dr. Andrea Vleming. Dr. Willard was part of this study, Frank Willard. The title was "The Functional Coupling of the Deep Abdominal and Paraspinal Muscles, the Effects of Simulated Paraspinal Muscle Contraction on Force Transmission to the Middle and Posterior Layer of the Thoracolumbar Fascia." Really fascinating article. So they were trying to understand how the thoracolumbar fascia, the abdominal and spinal muscles, cooperate to influence lumbopelvic motion and postural stability, primarily at the lumbosacral junction, and stability in the pelvis. So if we can better understand low back and pelvic girdle pain, we can be more effective in how we're treating our patients. And the majority of our patients, at least in the OMM clinic, are coming into our clinic. What I see routinely with the low back pain patients are poor trunk stabilizers, like the deep trunk stabilizers, and pelvic instability for a multitude of reasons. A lot of these patients have the postural functional asymmetry. So taking this back to the zinc model, where we're looking at how could the zinc model, the common compensatory pattern, also be a pattern of pain? Well, it could be a pattern of pain if there is functional asymmetry. You get functional asymmetry when you collapse down and you have a terrible collapsed sagittal imbalance, forward flexed posture, or the classic tech neck. So what are the muscular support systems of the pelvis and the core? We've got our global stabilizers. So our latissimus dorsi and the thoracolumbar fascia of the glute max. So the thoracolumbar fascia connects the glute max with the latissimus dorsi and the deep fascia of the limbs. And usually, the connection is opposite. So the right glute connects to the left latissimus dorsi. The left glute connects to the right latissimus dorsi through the thoracolumbar fascia. Then those are the global stabilizers. Then you have the local stabilizers, and those muscles are the multifidus, the transversus abdominis, or the TA, the diaphragm, and the pelvic floor. So the diaphragm above, the pelvic floor from below, the transversus abdominis wrapping around and connecting both diaphragm, pelvic floor, and the multifidus from behind. It forms this like beautiful cylinder that forms trunk stability. It's this like canister of muscles which supports and stabilizes your low back and your pelvis. It's really the keystone to the body, the cornerstone of the body. When you turn on your pelvic floor, you turn on your deep core stabilizers. When you turn on your deep core stabilizers, your transverse abdominis, your internal oblique, you turn on your pelvic floor, meaning there's co-contraction of those muscle groups. Just because you look like Arnold Schwarzenegger when he was Mr. Universe back in 1970 doesn't mean that you necessarily have a stable, strong core. You probably do, but not necessarily. I mean, you may have a six-pack, but, well, is the TA really strong? Are the obliques really strong? How's the diaphragm moving? What's your pelvic floor? Is that strong? Can you contract that? All right, so it's just something to think about. The diaphragm, this muscle plays a huge role, not only in keeping us alive by breathing, but also is hugely important as far as low back pain, lumbar stability, and pelvic stability. So contraction of the diaphragm is balanced by the contraction of the scalenes from above. The diaphragm, as we breathe in and out, alternates interthoracic and interabdominal pressures. So as we breathe in, you exhale in, the diaphragm drops down. That's going to increase interabdominal pressure and decrease interthoracic pressure. When you exhale, the opposite happens. Intra-abdominal pressure decreases, interthoracic pressure increases. Diaphragm, as we know, also works as a pump. Helps pump our lymphatic fluid, helps pump our venous fluid and return it back to the circulatory system, back to the heart. And then, as I mentioned before, it's a functional stabilizer. So it contributes to stabilization of the lumbar spine by increasing intra-abdominal pressure. So if you've seen those power lifters, they're taking a deep breath in, increasing their intra-abdominal pressure before they do their power lift. Why? Because that's creating pelvic and lumbar stability. It raises the intra-abdominal pressure prior to starting a functional task with the upper limbs, and it keeps it at high levels while the task is being carried out. When you think about when you lift, think about when you lift something next time. Think about your diaphragm. What's your diaphragm doing? Your diaphragm is contracting, or it should be contracting to stabilize to increase the intra-abdominal pressure and stabilize the lumbar spine and pelvis. When you increase the intra-abdominal pressure, you're also turning on your transversus abdominis. When you turn on your transverse abdominis, you're turning on your pelvic floor, right? Because as we mentioned before, the TA and the pelvic floor, they co-contract. Turn on one, you turn on the other. What we've seen with low back pain patients, they have altered breathing patterns. And many of patients with low back pain, you will find they are unable to take a deep breath. They're unable to feel the breath all the way into their pelvic floor, and you should. As your diaphragm contracts and you increase intra-abdominal pressure, your pelvic floor should drop, and you should feel that pelvic floor drop. If not, you're not taking a deep breath. What they've seen as well in low back patients is that their diaphragm has a lower thickness, so it's just weaker. As we mentioned before, you take a deep breath in, increasing intra-abdominal pressure, pelvic floor should drop, transverse abdominis should contract, pelvic floor also contracts. Take a deep breath now and feel that increase in intra-abdominal pressure. Feel the transverse abdominis turn on as you place your fingertips just to the lateral edge of your rectus abdominis. Feel your pelvic floor contract. give that a try. I love this analogy that I took from Peter Attia in his book, Outlive. He talked about core stability being like a can. I guess I like to think of it like a water bottle, right? When you have a full water bottle and you have the cap on, you try to squeeze the sides of the water bottle and you can't compress it. That's a strong core. That's analogous to a strong diaphragm, a strong pelvic floor, strong transversus abdominis, internal obliques, and multifidus. As soon as you pop the lid off or unscrew the lid off of the water bottle, you can crush that water bottle easily. That's what happens when any one of those core stabilizing muscles become weak. So the thoracolumbar fascia, it's this girdling system. It's a belt-like structure. It plays a huge role in posture, load transfer, and respiration. And there are three layers to it. The most important biomechanically are the posterior layer and the middle layer. So within the posterior layer, you have another division. You have the superficial lamina and you have the deep lamina. So the superficial lamina, we'll start with that. That is the aponeurosis of the latissimus dorsi. It's part of a collective sheath of fascia that goes all the way from the first rib and the xiphoid process anteriorly to the cranial base and then all the way down to the sacrum posteriorly. That's impressive. I had no idea that there was that fascial train from the xiphoid to the first rib, up to the cranial base, and then all the way down to the sacrum. It bridges all four diaphragms, all four transition zones, if you're thinking about the zinc model. And it's also this fascial sheath that covers the pecs, the rhomboids, the traps, and the serratus anterior. So that's the superficial lamina. Then you have the deep lamina, and that extends from the spinous processes to the transverse processes in the lumbar spine. It goes from the occipital bone and extends caudally to its fusion with the superficial lamina over the sacrum. The PLF, or the posterior lumbar fascia, the deep layer, girdles or goes around the lumbar erector spinae muscles and the multifidus muscles. So both the superficial lamina and the deep lamina of the posterior lumbar fascia helps to transfer load between the upper and the lower limbs. That's pretty interesting. It helps transfer load between the left and the right side of the body, the abdominal wall, and the lumbopelvic spine. So it's pretty important for creating stability. And when we talk about force transmission, you also have the common transversus abdominis tendon, right? One of our deep core stabilizing muscles. And this common transversus abdominis tendon, it's an anchor for force transmission between the abdominal muscles anteriorly and the paraspinal muscles posteriorly. And there's this really interesting myofascial triangle. It's called the lift. And it's this intermediary point of force transmission between your deep abdominal muscles and the paraspinal muscles within the thoracolumbar fascia. This little lift of this fascial triangle equalizes tension between the anterior muscles and the posterior muscles. So we're talking about postural stability. There's this girdling effect. So it's this myofascial axial ring between the thorax and the pelvis. So co-contraction or self-bracing of the spine, you have the paraspinal muscles and the transversus abdominis and internal oblique muscles acting through the common transversus abdominis tendon. You have this load shift to the PLF, or the posterior lumbar fascia, placing strain on the lumbar spinous processes, and the supraspinous ligaments. So essentially what happens when we talk about the girdling effect of the thoracolumbar fascia, you have horizontal force coming around the transversus abdominis through the internal oblique into the common transversus abdominis tendon, through the thoracolumbar fascia, into the spinous processes and transverse processes. It also blends into that supraspinous ligament, and then the force goes from horizontal to vertical. So when you have that system firing at all cylinders, not only are you creating lumbar stability, you're also creating decompression of the lumbar spine. So you're not being compressed. Going back to the tensegrity model, you're tensioning the system in a healthy way. You're practicing tensegrity. So when we talk about low back pain and pelvic instability, oftentimes there's going to be repetitive mechanical strain of the thoracolumbar fascia. That's going to reduce the effects of the common transversus abdominis tension and the paraspinal muscle complex. So you're not going to get an efficient girdling effect. You're going to have an unbalancing of the girdling effect, which could possibly lead to biomechanical low back pain. It could be an explanation for that. How do you decrease that? Well, you activate your TA, activate your paraspinal muscles, activate that myofascial ring, create spinal stability. You're going to decrease repetitive mechanical strain of the thoracolumbar fascia. That's really our goal here. Key takeaway points from this section. The TLF, or the thoracolumbar fascia, is necessary for functional postural symmetry and core stability. Got to have a healthy thoracolumbar fascia. The common transversus abdominis tendon links or anchors the abdominal muscles from in front and the paraspinal muscles from behind, which creates this girdling effect, this myofascial axial ring between the thorax and the pelvis. The thoracolumbar fascia, with the co-contraction of the TA, the obliques, and the erector spinae muscles, helps to create this girdling effect. We want to avoid repetitive mechanical strain, so being compressed, having a poor posture, turning off our deep trunk stabilizers to optimize function of the thoracolumbar fascia. So I've got some pictures here of good posture, right? So if you're standing up, you could just drop a plumb line that would have your ear over your shoulder, shoulder over your hips, hips over knees and ankles. If you're sitting, same thing. Screen at eye level, not having to flex your neck forward. Ears over shoulder, shoulder over hips. Hips at 90 degrees, knees over ankles, wrists in a neutral position at your keyboard. Ergonomics plays a big role in minimizing or diminishing low back pain. Fourth and final section. So we're 45 minutes in. Manipulative treatment of pelvic cross syndrome, a manifestation of functional asymmetry at the lumbosacral junction and the pelvic diaphragm. So here we're going to talk about the kinematics of a stable pelvis during the gait cycle. We're going to talk about what is pelvic cross syndrome. We're going to talk about pelvic cross syndrome and decelerating overuse syndromes as a manifestation of functional asymmetry. We're going to talk about how do you diagnose pelvic cross syndrome with the activation of deep core stabilizers and muscle firing patterns. And then we're going to do some demonstrations. Well, I'm just going to talk you through them. And we're going to practice a systematic treatment approach to pelvic cross syndrome. So we got to understand what the kinematics of the stable pelvis during the gait cycle are in the first place, right? We got to try to understand what is normal to understand what is abnormal. So if we talk about right pelvic pronation, that begins at right heel strike and ends at right toe off. what happens to the pubic bone and the stance femur approximate. The pelvis is going to flex in the sagittal plane, and it's going to internally rotate in the transverse plane towards the stance leg. You're going to have a right posterior nominate and a left anterior nominate. And the right pubic rami is going to be superior to the left. The sacrum is going to be on a right-on-right anterior sacral torsion. And the lumbar spine is going to follow type 1 motion. So it's going to be neutral, side bent to the right, and rotated left. So those are the normal kinematics of the stable pelvis during the gait, meaning that myofascial girdle is firing and is creating stability. So we have optimal joint range of motion and function. What is pelvic cross syndrome? So pelvic cross syndrome, which is also lower cross syndrome, also known by that name, was developed by, or I shouldn't say developed, was discovered, clinically discovered by Vladimir Janda. He was a Czech physician who developed the cross syndrome theory in 1979. And he talked about the inhibition or the weakness of trunk stabilizers and hip extensors with pelvic cross syndrome. So weak TA, internal and external oblique, glute max and glute med. He said there would be facilitation or overuse of hip flexors and adductors and spinal extensors. Primarily the iliopsoas is going to be really tight. The adductor longus is going to be really tight. That's the muscle that we use the most with hip flexion. The erector spinae would be tight. The multifidus would be hypertonic. And the QL would also be facilitated or overused. So tight hip flexors and adductors and spinal extensors. And then, this is why it's called cross syndrome, weak rectus abdominis, weak deep trunk stabilizers, TA, and weak glutes. So you can just draw this diagonal line of the muscles that are weak, draw another diagonal line in the opposite direction with the muscles that are tight. So you can look up online lower cross syndrome and find some great pictures of that, which is the same as pelvic cross syndrome. So pelvic cross syndrome implies a mechanical strain on the thoracolumbar fascia, so that repetitive mechanical strain. It is going to most likely cause sagittal plane imbalance because you just think about a terrible posture or someone who is hyperkyphotic in their thoracic spine. There's going to be what we call sagittal plane imbalance. So their rectus abdominis, the TA, is going to be turned off. I'm just kind of repeating what I already said. That's going to elongate and stretch in a bad way, the erector spinae muscles. And those muscles are just going to be really, really tight because they're being stretched to their maximum length. The adductors are going to be really, really tight because you have that posteriorly rotated pelvis. So those muscles are going to be stretched to their max and tight. And then glutes often are going to be not firing because you have poor arthrokinematics of the SI joint. So it just paints this picture of pelvic cross syndrome. With pelvic cross syndrome, you often have deceleration overuse syndrome. So the glutes get turned off, which causes dysfunction at the lumbar sacral joint, the SI joint. What happens is the mechanoreceptors and the proprioceptors in the SI joint send poor information back to the spinal cord of where the joint is in 3D space. You get inaccurate joint pressures and speeds of motion of that joint, inaccurate tensions in the joint and the associated ligaments. So you're just going to send really poor information back to the spinal cord. Then the spinal cord is going to send poor information of which muscles to fire in and around the joint to stabilize the joint. So you get glute max inhibition. You get loss of force closure of the sacrum through the thoracolumbar fascia. That's going to cause oftentimes backward sacral torsions right on left and left on rights. You're going to get diminished stabilization of the SI joint in mid stance when it's being loaded the most. And then you're going to get facilitation of the biceps femoris and pronius longus. Those muscles are going to be doing the hip extension because the glute is turned off. And if you stretch those muscles, that's not going to do anything because you're not getting at the root of the cause, which is reestablishing proper joint mechanics at the SI joint. And I think that's where, that is where manipulation comes in, restoring proper biomechanics at the lumbosacral junction, at the pubic symphysis, at the SI joint, at the sacrum. Greenman's approach to pelvic cross syndrome, being trained at MSU, I've got to mention Greenman, got to mention Greenman's principle of manual medicine, written by the great Dr. Lisa DiStefano. So if we're going to diagnose and talk about manipulative treatment of pelvic cross syndrome, we're going to start with the pubic symphysis. We're going to look at the innominates to see if there's any shear. We're going to look at how the thoracolumbar junction is moving, looking at the diaphragm, checking biomechanical movement of the lumbar spine, and checking our sacrum, doing our sacral diagnosis. We're going to treat the areas of dysfunction that we find. We're going to treat functional asymmetry. We're going to give them mobilization techniques. We're going to show them neuromuscular re-education exercises and strength exercises. So once we reestablish healthy biomechanics and the system, we feel less tension, greater mobility. We need to give them strengthening exercises to help them continue to maintain that stability. Manual medicine, I feel, or in my experience, which is not a lot, is trial and error. I like to use the analogy of OMM, or manual manipulation, is like WD-40. So with water displacement 40, it's called 40 because they came up with 39 solutions that didn't work. The 40th worked. So hopefully it doesn't take you 40 treatments to figure out what's going on with a patient. But what I'm saying is you try some counter strain of the QL and that doesn't work. You try some myofascial release, that doesn't work. You try some muscle energy, that doesn't work. And then you try some FDM and, oh, seems to have less tension, or seems to that 12th rib is moving better now, and there's better biomechanics of that innominate on the same side of the tight QL. So that's just been my experience. I'm not sure what your all's experience have been. So we can get a good sense of the deep core stabilizing muscles, how strong they are and how well they can engage if we have the patient just lie on their back and we check for segmental control of the lumbar spine. So how well does their TA, the obliques, the pelvic floor, the latifidus, and the diaphragm, how strong are they? We look at segmental control. Patient lies supine. They roll their pelvis into the 12 o'clock position. They draw their umbilicus to the floor segmentally, starting with L1 and then moving segmentally to L2, 3, 4, 5. If they can do that, great. If they can't do that, their core is compromised in some way. There's most likely some inhibition of some muscle of the deep core stabilizers, probably because there is some range of motion restriction at one of the joints of the either thoracic or lumbar spine or the SI joint or the pubic symphysis. And that's where you put on your Sherlock Holmes thinking cap and you go hunting for what could possibly be driving this somatic dysfunction that I'm finding? Or rather, find the potential somatic dysfunction that is causing this muscle imbalance of my core stabilizers. Something else that I think is important to do is look at the myofascial firing pattern with hip extension. So having your patient lying face down and having them actively bring up their leg into hip extension, and you're palpating hamstring, glute, and erector spinae. Those muscles, as they bring their leg into hip extension, should fire in that order. Hamstrings first, then glutes, then erector spinae. If they don't, you got to figure out why. Where is the inhibition coming from? So we start with looking at our pubic symphysis. So the pubic symphysis is this fibrocartilaginous joint and disc. It has superior and inferior motion, separation and compression motion, anterior and posterior motion. It distributes force from the femur into the pelvis and the SI joint. Dysfunctions in the pubic symphysis increase load into the SI joint. And there have been studies that have seen a positive correlation with pubic symphysis changes on X-ray and SI joint pain. There's a clinical correlation with pelvic cross syndrome, and that's why we're talking about it here. You'll find a neuromuscular imbalance or some functional asymmetry. You'll find tight adductors and an inferior pubic symphysis on the same side of the inferior pubic symphysis. Usually you'll find ipsilateral glute max inhibition on the side of that inferior pubic symphysis, and then weak lower abdominal muscles. Again, painting the picture of pelvic cross or lower cross syndrome. You can do muscle energy to treat the pubic symphysis, and I'm not going to go over that here. There are different ways to treat the pubic symphysis. I'm not going to talk about that in great detail. It's also important to look at the iliolumbar ligament. And you could do iliolumbar ligament myofascial release to restore sacroiliac joint motion. So treatment is essential to normalize lumbosacral junction motion. Patient can be treated seated or prone. If lying prone, so face down, you just get on that iliolumbar ligament, which is going to attach to the L4-5 transverse process and then attach to the ilium, and feel for the tension in the ligament. And then myofascial release, either direct or indirect, to release the fascia. If seated and treating the left iliolumbar ligament, you can place your arm around the patient, kind of wrapping their shoulders with your left arm, and then take your right thumb and you can feel at the transverse process of L4 and 5 and kind of run your thumb down to the ilium and just feel for tension, and then treat myofascially that iliolumbar ligament either with direct or indirect myofascial release. You can also kind of rock the patient from side to side and kind of side bend them into that ligament with your thumb applying tension if you wanted to do it directly. So talk about manipulation to restore the thoracolumbar fascia motion. There are relative contraindications to myofascial release. Those would be, fractures, open wounds, thermal injuries, soft tissue infection, osteomyelitis, and there are others. When are we going to treat the thoracolumbar fascia? Well, when there's limited motion there, when we find lack of glidability, where it feels stuck, the tissue feels congested, the fascia feels thick, and we think that there's a potential correlation to the chief complaint. There are many different ways to restore thoracolumbar fascial motion. You can diagnose it with upper extremity or lower extremity traction and thinking about, where do I feel fascial restriction when I try to pull through that fascial train that we talked about in previous slides? You could do the pelvic rock, pelvic translation, and trying to feel where is that myofascial restriction. You could also look at the rib cage and translate and compress the rib cage to get a sense of how the fascial system is moving or where the restriction may be. Treatment, of course, could be direct or indirect. And the mechanism of action of myofascial release, we are influencing the mechanoreceptors and proprioceptors of the fascia, and we're restoring proper myofascial tone and neural synapses. I talked about the fascial distortion model as a treatment for the thoracolumbar fascia. We know there are six different types, thanks to Dr. Tipaldos, of the fascial distortion model. I only talked about trigger bands and herniated trigger points. So when we talk about FDM for treating the thoracolumbar fascia, we think about potentially having herniated trigger points in those areas. And these herniated trigger points are pathological herniations of tissue through a fascial plane. So we think about deep layers of fascia herniating through superficial layers of fascia, oftentimes herniating through areas of weakness, such as the neurovascular tracts. It's a simple treatment. You take your thumb where the patient is pointing to the area of discomfort with usually, you know, this, it's sign language that guides our treatment. So the patient will point to the area, you know, they say oftentimes with two fingers, you place your thumb there and apply, will feel for that herniated fascial tissue and then apply deep pressure to try and reduce that fascial herniation. Recheck to see if what you palpated before is gone and then check the fascial movement, see if that's changed. Usually the patient will say, wow, that hurt a lot when you treated me, but the pain that I had before has changed. Obviously, like anything, it's not 100% of the time, but I have got pretty good results with that. And that's, of course, you know, putting on your doctor hat as well and not just pushing blindly, but ruling out anything else that could be going on. Kidney stones could be causing something like this. Muscle strains could be causing something like this. It also could be, you know, a combination of fascia as well as the myofascial QL or the multifidus, deep erector spinae muscles, all of that. So it's important to keep your differential broad and then with your physical exam and the history to hone in on what you think may be going on. Then we have the trigger bands. So we're talking about treatment of the thoracolumbar fascia, treating trigger bands. So trigger bands within the fascial distortion model are these twisted or wrinkled fascial fibers that cause a burning or pulling pain along the course of the fascial band. Again, the patient guides you, in this case, by running their fingers in a precise area. Usually they'll say, you know, the pain hurts right through here, and they'll take their fingertips and run it along a line. And then again, you're feeling for what you are imagining to be and imagining to be this fascial band, this twisted band of fascia. And you're taking your thumb and running it along that band that you're palpating, asking the patient if you're on that band of pain, ironing it out with your thumb, rechecking fascial glide, and seeing if there are tissue texture changes and if the discomfort or pain is better. We got to talk about the sacrum. Of course, we have to talk about the sacrum. So if we talk about sacral structure, we talk about this passive subsystem where we have bone, cartilage, and ligaments. Sacrum is, of course, going to be involved in pelvic cross syndrome. So we have in the SI joint, hyaline cartilage in the anterior side of the SI joint, fibrocartilage in the posterior SI joint. Then you have your sacroiliac tuberous and spinous ligaments, which are the big ligaments, the important ligaments in the SI joint. The SI joint is this closely fitting joint. You have an auricular surface on the side of the ilium, meaning it looks like an ear. It's slightly billowed out, and the sacral side of the SI joint is concave, so it's a little bit inverted. And that creates an increase in friction force between the billow side and the concave side and creates more stability. The SI joint is wider superiorly than it is inferiorly and wider anteriorly than it is posteriorly. That also creates this wedge and increases the stability within that joint. So there are many different ways to do manipulation to restore SI joint mobility. I wanted to treat using facilitated positional release of the sacrum, which I thought the Chuna manual medicine physicians hadn't had much exposure to, so hopefully I could teach them something new. The principle is to decrease muscle hypertonicity, possibly causing the sacral dysfunction. So how do you diagnose? The patient lies prone. Each ILA is motion tested by pushing with your palms, obviously asking for permission to do this and explaining what you're going to do, but putting your palms on the ILA and then pushing towards the head or cephalad and just seeing which side doesn't move as much as the other side. The side that doesn't move is a side of dysfunction. I often tell myself or explain to my patients that I'm a movement specialist and I try with their help to restore motion. So the side that's not moving is the side of dysfunction. There's less freedom of motion. So you place a pillow under the thigh on the side of restricted motion. The heel of the hand goes below the ILA on the side of the restricted motion with the fingers monitoring the SI joint. The other hand is going to internally rotate the lower extremity on the side of restriction to unpack the SI joint. Then you're applying a cephalad compression at the ilia. You're going to abduct the lower extremity until motion at the SI joint is palpated. Then you push the patient's leg toward the floor. The sacrum should raise into the palpating hand. As the patient exhales, push the ILA cephalad. So that's the treatment. Check the leveling after treatment at the sacral base and at the ILA to see if there was a change that was made. You can have the patient take a deep breath in while you're checking sacral base and the ILA and just see if there is counternutation and nutation, that if that has been restored or if there's better motion at the SI joint. You could also do myofascial release to restore the SI joint motion. And this can be done indirectly or directly. If you're doing it indirect, the dysfunctional tissues are guided along the path of least resistance until free movement is achieved. Direct, we're taking it into the restrictive fascial barrier, and the tissue is loaded with a constant force until tissue release occurs. Place your dominant hand along the long axis of the sacrum with the third digit along the spinous process of L5 and the second and fourth digit along the SI joint. Place the non-dominant hand horizontally across the sacrum between the two posterior superior iliac spines, and then rock the sacrum into nutation and counternutation and circumferentially, so clockwise and counterclockwise, while feeling for tightness or looseness in the fascial system. Pay close attention to what L5 is doing in relation to the sacrum, as well as tension in the iliolumbar ligament. So I think that's really important as we're treating any patient to be thinking about, what are the structures anatomically that I'm palpating? What do they feel like before treatment, during treatment, and then after treatment? So after we've done all this, then we want to recheck the deep pelvic core stabilizers. So then get our patient to lie on their back, put our hand under their lumbar spine, and ask them to rotate their pelvis into the 12 o'clock position and draw their umbilicus to the table segmentally, starting with L1, then going to 2, 3, 4, and 5. It's important to see if there's been a change after you've done manipulation. And sometimes I really like this analogy that Dr. Jamie Mueller-Smith, who I've been working with, used. She said, you know, OMT sometimes can be like taking the cookies out of the oven. When you take them out of the oven, they're not done, but they're still cooking. They're still hot. So OMT can be like that. You know, you treat them, you're not getting the results that you were hoped for immediately following treatment, but that doesn't mean that the treatment didn't work. It's still, the body is still kind of rewiring neurologically and growing accustomed to these biomechanical tissue texture changes that have been made. So don't get discouraged if you're not getting the results that you want immediately after treatment. Oftentimes it doesn't work like that. FDM, I would say, is the exception to the rule. And then when we talk about pelvic cross syndrome and we say, hey, you know, let's work on our posture, it's not enough to just say, sit upright, roll your pelvis forward, sit on your pelvic floor, put your ears over your shoulders, shoulder over hips, knees above ankles. It's not enough to just say that. We also have to teach our patients how to strengthen their trunk stabilizers. So a very easy exercise to do is have your patients get into that good upright seated posture, have them place their fingertips at the side of the rectus abdominis, and then just lean forward until they feel their, or excuse me, lean backwards until they feel that transversus abdominis engage. And then hold that position for a minute or two. That's engaging, that's working their transversus abdominis. That's one way to help restore those deep trunk stabilizers. Okay, what did we learn? Structure and function are intimately related. The Zinc model is a postural model rooted in tensegrity. Fascia plays a key role in tensegrity. It has contractile capability. It aids in tissue gliding. It's innervated. It's a pain generator, especially if there is repetitive mechanical strain. There is the girdling effect of the thoracolumbar fascia. It is such an important fascial system when we talk about lumbar stability, pelvic stability. It forms this myofascial axial ring between the thorax and the pelvis. And then finally, we talked about treatment for pelvic cross syndrome. We diagnosed pelvic cross syndrome by checking the activation and control of core stabilizing muscles. We looked at the pubic symphysis and how that could be treated with muscle energy, although I didn't explain that. We looked at the SI joint and we looked at treating that with facilitated positional release and myofascial release. And then we looked at the thoracolumbar fascia and treating that with myofascial release and FDM. And then finally, we went over chair backs for strengthening the deep core stabilizers, particularly the transversus abdominis, which, as we know, co-contracts with the pelvic floor. I want to end with this quote from John Lewis's book, A.T. Still, From the Dry Bone to the Living Man, an incredible read. You can find it, I believe, on Amazon. It's difficult to get, or it might take a little while to be shipped, but every osteopath, every DO, I would hope that they read this book. Here's the quote. Still leads us to the same fork he reached on that momentous day in June 1874. That's when he came up with the idea of osteopathy. To control nature with limited knowledge, or to humble ourselves in the face of the great mystery, acknowledge our ignorance, and remove obstruction to nature's unceasing self-regulation. Hope you guys enjoyed this little lecture, and hope you learned something from it. And if you have any questions, please feel free to email me at the onmmpodcast@gmail.com, and we'll see you in the next episode. Thanks for tuning in.